This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Today's conversation is a rebroadcast of a discussion on beneficial bugs that aired earlier in September. Our phone lines won't be live for this rebroadcast, but feel free to share your stories about the good guys in your garden by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We were joined in the studio by Darcy Oishi. He's a biological control section chief for the Department of Agriculture. He oversees programs relating to pest detection, emergency response, and biocontrols. Chrissy Mogren is an assistant researcher at the University of Hawaii specializing in pollinator ecology. Her research focuses on ways to make the environment healthier for bees. And Andrew Nowinski is known as the Bug Doctor. He handles green pest control workshops for the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. Welcome to you all. Today we're talking about the good guys, the good bugs. I'm glad you're here today because we've got a fun subject to tackle. And I want to start out by going around the table. Let me know about your favorite bug. Chrissy, do you have one?
I know, I just told you I did, and now I changed my mind. So I think for today, my favorite bug is going to be the carpenter bee. They're a mixed bag. Obviously, they can be an issue here in Hawaii and other places as structural pests, but they're also really important pollinators, and in Hawaii, specifically of lilikoi. So today, they're my favorite insect.
Okay. You know, and I just think that I haven't seen a lot of carpenter bees recently. I mean, I remember seeing more of them before.
Well, I think part of that may be due to, you know, their role as structural pests, and a lot more people are working towards eradication around their homes. And there's also the potential, as we have introduced species here in Hawaii, honeybees being one of them, it's possible that they can transmit certain diseases when they visit flowers. If the second visitor is a different species of bee, there's the potential that any disease particles left behind could be picked up by that individual and then enter a new species. So there's also the potential that carpenter bees may be affected by some of these viruses as well.
Okay, but if you have lilikoi, you want to invite those carpenter bees in your yard.
Absolutely.
Okay. What about you, Andrew?
Well, mine would be the praying mantis.
Okay.
You know, they're fascinating insects, and basically they're guardians of the garden, and they take care of a lot of the bad bugs that are attracted to your garden.
And I don't see a lot of those in my yard anymore either.
Again, you know, it has to do with the environment and what's happening. Chemicals being used or misused, because when you spray with chemicals today, you're killing a lot of good bugs, unfortunately, and the good bugs suffer.
Okay, well,
due
yeah.
to that overspraying.
Yeah, and maybe you can share some ideas about how people can get away from maybe some of those chemicals and what can we use that's more natural.
Well, there are chemicals that are non-repellent and targeted pests. You can use diatomaceous earth, basically. It's a natural product. You can mix with your soil when you're prepping your garden. And it doesn't repel the insects, and it only takes care of the bad bugs that are crawling around. And you can mix it up with water, or you can apply it as a dust, and it works pretty good. And it, you know, doesn't, and you basically, when you apply chemical, you got to find a target pest that you're going after. You don't want to spray everything, you know, spray your whole yard, and it's for killing everything. And unfortunately, there are people using those type of chemicals. And what you spray today, they're immune tomorrow.
Right, yeah, so you got to be careful about what you
do. Yes, definitely.
What about you, Darcy? You have a favorite bug?
That's like asking me to pick my favorite child.
Okay.
It's really unfair. But I would say of my biocontrol agents, probably Aeroplectris dimeris, the biocontrol agent for the stinging nettle caterpillar, because it acts more the most like a xenomorph.
Okay, but you use some big words that I don't know. Is there a common name?
So, no, there's no. It's the parasitoid for the stinging nettle caterpillar. And what it does is it lays its eggs underneath the caterpillar's body, and they hatch and develop inside the caterpillar. And a few days later, little parasitoids emerge.
And it's like bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye stinging nettle caterpillar.
Oh,
and it leaves a nice little mummy behind.
Oh, wow. curious. Okay. Well, you know, Chrissy, you deal a lot with pollinators, right? And people think honeybees, right? You want to see more of those around.
Absolutely. So here in Hawaii, we actually have 19 introduced species of bees, and these are the ones that you're most likely to come across in home gardens and in agricultural areas. We do have, it's about 70 species of native bees. They're all the Hawaiian yellow-faced bees, but they largely have very close associations with native plants. So, you know, when we talk about pollinator conservation here in Hawaii, it's actually, you know, we're mostly talking about, from what most people are thinking of, is preservation and enhancement of populations of many of these introduced bees, which are very, very important for agricultural pollination services and then also pollination in home gardens. Honeybees are the only introduced social bee, so they work collectively together to collect nectar and convert that into honey. They're collecting pollen and in the process pollinating plants, which is what they then convert into a substance called bee bread that they feed to their developing larvae. So when it comes to enhancing, you know, pollinator populations, doing something good for one is going to be great for the honeybees as well.
Is there something that you can plant then to encourage, you know, one type of bee, you know, over the next or what?
Actually, yes. So when we talk about bees and choosing plants for specific types of bees, one thing we talk about is tongue length. So different types of bees have different length mouth parts. And so if you think about our native yellow-faced Hylaeus, they have really short tongues. And if you think about something like a bumblebee, which we don't have in Hawaii, but they have really long tongues. Honeybees are a generalist, what we call, you know, a generalist pollinator. They can feed on lots of different types of flowers, and they're mid-length. They fall right in the middle. And so if you want to attract certain types of pollinators, you have to plant a flower shape that's appropriate to their mouth type. So if you want to attract pollinating flies or short-tongued bees, you would plant a flower that is more open-faced, so something kind of like a daisy. You think something that type of floral shape. If you want to attract bees with a longer tongue, you'd plant flowers that have a longer corolla. So that's, you know, is it a tubular-shaped flower? So the deeper that is, the longer the tongue you kind of need to have to access the nectar in the bottom.
Okay. And then, I remember on a previous show, we had Ethel from the Honeybee Project up at the University of Hawaii, and she shared that as far as mango trees, that she said, yeah, if you want lots of mangoes next season, put a dead tilapia in your tree because it attracts flies. And flies, she said, are very effective pollinators for mango trees, which was interesting. I didn't know that.
It's absolutely true. There's a number of crop plants in Hawaii. Our honeybees are generalists, so they can pollinate them, but they're not always the most efficient. And in the case of mango as well as avocado, the flowers are better pollinated by flies. If you think about the flower, they're very open, so they need something with a short tongue to get in there and get the job done. And in the case of those two crop plants, it is, in fact, a fly. If you think about how flowers smell, we call these pollination syndromes. So if you have flowers that smell very sweet during the day, they're probably pollinated by bees. If something smells kind of gross, it's probably pollinated by a fly. So you think there's a corpse flower, right? It literally smells like a rotting body. And they do that to attract flies that would, you know, go to rotting meat, tricks them into coming in and pollinating it. And so it's kind of along the same lines when you think about mango and avocado flowers. Alternatively, if something has a super long corolla or a really long tube flower and it smells lovely at night, that's going to be pollinated by a moth.
Okay. And then, Darcy, we were talking about biocontrols, and, you know, we do have a large number of beekeepers, I think, on the Big Island, and you mentioned that there was some concern, some controversy about some biocontrols.
Yeah, so the department has been looking into controlling a plant called Christmasberry. It's a very weedy plant. It grows quickly, overgrows a lot of things, and this is actually a good nectar and pollen source for bees. So you can actually produce a honey which is very unique. It has a little peppery taste to it. It's a nice honey. I like it myself. It's pollinating. Bees are generalist pollinators. They will pollinate things that in some cases would be actually a lot of weeds are pollinated by honeybees. And this is one of the weeds that we have concerns over because it just literally can dominate a landscape.
So it's invasive.
Highly invasive.
Okay. So while you are trying to manage that, there may be some beekeepers on the Big Island that aren't real happy about that.
Right. It's true. And I mean, honeybees, because they are themselves an invasive species, I mean, it can be a mixed bag at times, right? So they were purposely introduced to Hawaii in the late 1800s, specifically for, you know, honey production and also pollination of certain plants. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the weeds that we have in Hawaii have been introduced from areas where either the western honeybee, which is the species we have in the state, is native to, or other species of honeybees that are present in Asia. So when these plants then come to Hawaii, where honeybees are, they're going to be very effective. Part of that is also because the nutrient ratios in the pollen specifically are what honeybees are seeking for their diet and their ability to reproduce and effectively rear their young, whereas some native plants may not have that optimal type of nutrient ratios because they've historically evolved to be pollinated by different native pollinators in the state. Yeah.
So an example is Ohia produces a very popular honey. It's a really nice honey, but it's also not very good for bees. They don't have a lot of pollen that bees can use to supplement their diets. And so it's just like they're running on sugar. So when a crop like Christmas berry comes up, they're going to get a lot of the other nutrients that they need, boost their health up. And then, you know, they're then ready to take on the next pollen crop or honey crop, which usually I think is macadamia after that, which also has its own issues because macadamia is not pollinated naturally by bees. It's pollinated by a fly.
Fly. Oh, a special kind of fly?
Yes. You know? Yes. In where macadamia is native, it's fly pollinated.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Today's conversation is a rebroadcast of a discussion on beneficial bugs that aired earlier in September. Our phone lines won't be live for this rebroadcast, but feel free to share your stories about the good guys in your garden by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We were joined in the studio by Darcy Oishi. He's a biological control section chief for the Department of Agriculture. He oversees programs relating to pest detection, emergency response, and biocontrols. Chrissy Mogren is an assistant researcher at the University of Hawaii specializing in pollinator ecology. Her research focuses on ways to make the environment healthier for bees. And Andrew Nowinski is known as the Bug Doctor. He handles green pest control workshops for the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. And Andy, I've taken a class, a good bug, bad bug workshop over at the Halawa facility there. And I remember I recall that they were saying, oh, if you have orange flowers or yellow flowers, that sometimes can attract bad bugs.
Yes.
Talk about that.
It depends on, you know, we got traps, orange color, and it'll take care of all the bad bugs, you know, and basically it helps that. But also changing your light bulbs to orange, it takes care of the night insects that fall and create a problem with ants, centipedes, all the crawling insects that come from the outside. As far as yellow is an attractant. That's why certain type of flowers will attract. You know, Christian mentioned about attracting flies. I tell people who do at Xeriscape to add in your compost and your mixing is cow manure, dry cow manure, chicken manure. You mix that up. Every time you water, you attract flies. They pollinate. And also I tell my guests that they should, I tell them to get the hummingbird.
The feeder?
The feeder. And you put your honey your sweet water in. You also attract all kinds of bees, like carpenter bees, honeybees, to your garden, thus improving your pollination and your fruit-bearing trees.
And the other thing I recall is that numbers. You know, that if you have a certain type of a bug and you see a lot of them, that maybe those are the bad bugs? Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. A lot of times it is the bad bugs, and unfortunately, when you have introduced insects, which we have coming in daily almost, and it takes 7 to 10 years before you notice these bugs. So basically, you'll see a population growth, and all of a sudden, you know, you have a rain or attracted to light. You go to hotels that had spotlights facing the ocean. Next thing, they're covered with bugs. They're attracted at, you know. And again, they're attracted to plants, certain type of plants. That's why in your garden, you also mix herbs as a repellent, you know, which helps. So the more mixed you have in your garden, the better it is. You know, your vegetables, everything. And you plant your herbs, you plant your flowers. It's a win-win situation.
Okay, we have a call coming in from the Big Island. Richard, what's on your mind?
Hi, is this the Richard me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. I wanted to ask a question because I have a coffee farm in Kona. And I'm trying to get rid of the Christmas berry. And I have a fireplace because it's cold up at my altitude. And I was told that you can't cook over that kind of wood because it makes the food bad. So I just had a question that could those bad, dangerous chemicals at all be in the honey?
Darcy, you want to take that one?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't think it makes it into the nectar, and if it's not in the nectar, it's not getting into the honey, basically.
I don't know, but I just thought, well, I didn't know if you would know the answer, but I have a second question, if it's okay.
Sure.
So on a coffee flower, what size tongue do the, and should I, and during the day, smells good, so I should think that the bees are pollinating?
Yes. So coffee is going to be pollinated by honeybees. They do visit it, and they actually make a lovely honey that tastes a bit like butterscotch from coffee flowers. So they are visited by honeybees, but, I mean, certainly as a coffee grower, you'll know they don't have to be pollinated in order to make the coffee cherry. So pollination does help make the yield larger. I believe it's around 30% increase in yield that'll be achieved by having honeybees visit the coffee flowers.
Any other thoughts around the table about coffee and pollinators and good bugs?
Oh, all my other coffee things are bad bugs.
Are bad bugs. Okay. All right. Well, so what are some other bugs that are out there that people might have some misconceptions about that they think they're bad, but they're really good?
That's like a never-ending list.
Well, what about spiders? What can you tell us about spiders?
Spiders are great. They're generalists. They're predators, basically. So most of what is bothering you, they're going to be consuming. They'll consume a lot of. It's like a never-ending list, but spiders are good. They just happen to be in places where you don't want them to be.
Well, no, I remember seeing the, you know, those big cane spiders, right, or the daddy long legs, and you're like, whoa, that's like kind of spooky if you don't like, you know, those types
the
of
creatures.
The
cane spider is more afraid of you than you are of it.
Yes, they'll basically run away from you the minute you turn on your lights. They're there taking care of your house in areas where you have termite swarms, you have ant swarming, or pantry pests that swarm at night attracted to your TV or your lamp next to you that's on at night. And basically, you know, they eat the bugs and they feed their young. And basically, it's a cycle. So they know when to come up and reproduce and for next time, because they're seasonal too. So the only thing you do is leave them be, and they'll do their job. And when the swarm is over, they disappear, they die off. But they have the eggs that hatch next season.
Do we generally have more bugs in the summer? Then what season?
It's spring and fall.
Spring and fall. Okay.
Yes. All those right. are basically the time you're going to have an increase in insect population.
Okay, we have a call coming in. John from the Big Island, what's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple of questions. One is, my main issue is a plant. It's an invasive species that has little blueberries on it, and the nickname for it is called Coster's Curse. And anyway, it's extremely tough plant, and I have 3 acres up in South Glenwood in a deep rainforest. My driveway is almost a quarter mile long, and all of a sudden in the last year, this plant has taken over my driveway quickly. And it's got little blueberries on it that are edible. I eat them all the time, but it's producing so many berries and reproducing itself. My question is there any way to get rid of this thing without messing up the Ina? I've got a lot of other plants that are growing here besides this invasive weed. And it's a tough thing. Once it gets growing, it has a base on it that's like wood. The easy thing is you can snap it off, but it's grown so much on both sides of my driveway, and I'm old and disabled. Is there anything I can do with this plant to at least knock it back?
What do you think, Darcy?
So Coster's Curse is a melastome, so it's related to Myconia and a whole suite of weeds that are present here in Hawaii, and it's been one of our long-term targets for biological control. There's been a few agents that have been released against it to control it, and the Forest Service is actually looking at Coster's Curse as an active target of biocontrol. But that said, our natural enemies really are targeted at slowing it down and really expanding our ability to engage in integrated pest management. Coster's Curse is just like Myconia, it's going to be something really tough to control from a biocontrol standpoint.
Is there a spray that you can use that's not going to hurt the bees?
So there are various herbicides that could be used to help in terms of management, and basically that's what I would suggest, because Coster's Curse is one of those plants that can dominate a landscape and quickly overrun everything else.
Like, is there the name of something you could suggest, or should he call the office? I mean, to find out what the list of things are.
And I'm not allowed to give references for chemical control.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, so then, what should he do?
There's various formulations that you can look up on the web that will target. I'm not sure if he wants to use chemical controls that can target weeds like Coster's Curse.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Today's conversation is a rebroadcast of a discussion on beneficial bugs that aired earlier in September. Our phone lines won't be live for this rebroadcast, but feel free to share your stories about the good guys in your garden by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217. We were joined in the studio by Darcy Oishi. He's a biological control section chief for the Department of Agriculture. He oversees programs relating to pest detection, emergency response, and biocontrols. Chrissy Mogren is an assistant researcher at the University of Hawaii, specializing in pollinator ecology. Her research focuses on ways to make the environment healthier for bees. And Andrew Nowinski is known as the Bug Doctor. He handles green pest control workshops for the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. What other things can people do if they're worried about spraying something that's going to kill all the bad bugs? Some good resources?
Number one is EPA has all the labels and MSDS or the what's harmful. And always read the label. You know, unfortunately, people don't read the label. Make sure it has the target pest that you're trying to get and follow the label. You know, if it says crack and crevice, make sure you put it in the crack and crevices. And there are very few chemicals out there that you can do surface treatments today, although most of the chemicals that you can buy is all pyrethrum or pyrethroids, man-made or natural. And by the time you spray it, you say you spray it in the morning, by later on this evening, it's gone because the UV light from the sun is so powerful in Hawaii, it just burns it up.
And the pyrethrins, those are from chrysanthemum
from
flowers.
From chrysanthemum. That's the natural. But then you have the man-made, and they're pyrethroids, or, you know, and basically they're man-made, and they're made from different chemicals, different additives. Some of them smell, and those don't even, they got more inner ingredients than necessary that do more harm than the chemical themselves.
I know when I took one of the classes at the Board of Water Supply, one of the things they brought up was when you're treating for slugs,
mm-hmm.
They said you can put some of those pellets in a little kind of a plastic PVC pipe elbow.
Yep.
You put it in there because the slugs like the dark areas, yep. and that way you're not broadcasting generally and it may not affect something else. I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah. If you do slug control, unfortunately, all the chemicals like methaldehyde is harmful to your pets. So basically what you want to do is go natural. You can go with, they have traps now that you can dig a hole, put it in there, just put beer in it, do that in the evening, come in the morning, they're all drowned, you pick them up, put them in a brown bag, throw them away.
How come my slugs just seem to drink the beer and then, I don't know.
Probably not strong enough.
It's a light beer.
Yeah, it's the yeast in the beer that attracts them. The thing is, you have to get a smooth surface. It has to be glass or stainless steel or porcelain. So they can't crawl up. They'll slide down. They can't get a grip of it. The other one is just putting a board on the ground. And every morning, just pick it up, turn it up, and they'll be underneath there if you have slugs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good tip.
Yeah. So basically, there's different things you can do other than poisoning them. And at the same time, when you kill the slugs, regardless if you're using Hawaiian salt and putting it on them, they will create a fly problem down the line because they're... It's like a piece of meat that you throw out there, and the flies will lay their eggs and feed on their carcass.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today's show is a rebroadcast spotlighting the good bugs in our gardens and what can we do to encourage them. Our guests are Chrissy Mogren, who is broadly interested in how the landscape can be designed and enhanced to promote pollinator health, particularly by adding flowering plants that meet the nutritional needs of honeybees and other pollinators. Andrew the Bug Doctor Nowinski teaches public workshops on green pest control. And we also have the Department of Agriculture's Darcy Oishi. Our phone lines will not be live for this rebroadcast, but we do want to hear from you. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Share your stories about gardening with the good guys. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Have you heard about the Ornish Lifestyle Program? Could it really be the key to reversing heart disease? Can people incorporate the changes before they have a heart attack, and does it work? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk about the main components of the Ornish program and how this could help you or someone you love with their heart health. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Coming Saturday, November 23rd, it's a little bit of Appalachia in the middle of Honolulu when Saloon Pilots bring their signature bluegrass and Americana sound to HPR's Atherton Studio. They'll play a blend of originals and classic tunes on fiddle, banjo, guitar, bass, and drums. It's sure to be a good old time. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org, sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
You are back with The Conversation, and we're going to head to Maui. Kathy from Lahaina has a question.
Aloha, folks.
Aloha. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is flies. I've always been told that they carry disease, and you got to kill them. And so I heard you say that bees pollinate, but also flies do. And I'm going, wait a second, what are they saying? The house flies are going to pollinate things? So I'd like some clarification on that, please.
Well, thanks for calling, Kathy. And the clarification is you are correct. It's kind of a mixed bag. So some flies can transmit disease, and that's not because the flies themselves are diseased. It's just because of what they land on and what they feed on. So, you know, we talked about, hey, hang a dead fish in your mango tree to get it, you know, pollinated. Well, you know, a dead fish, as it's, you know, breaking down, could potentially have some harmful bacteria. So if a fly lands on that, you're having a picnic, and then it lands on your food. That's how some of these diseases could be transferred. So in that case, flies would be dirty. But at the same time, you know, you're going to require their services. So there are a number of different species of flies. So when we say flies, we're not just referring to one kind. There are some flies that are specific. Their biology requires that they visit rotting meat, which is then why they can also be co-opted by plants to pollinate their flowers when the flowers smell a little stinky. But there's also a bunch of really good flies. So things like hoverflies. We also call them syrphid flies or bee flies sometimes. They're relatively small, maybe about a quarter of an inch in length. They look like little bees because they're black and yellow striped, and they visit flowers, and they're pollinators, and they're really great. And we do have a lot of those in the state as well. Those are not going to visit something dirty and then land on your picnic. So those are okay to have around. And what's great about them is that their larval or immature stage is also predaceous. So they kind of look a bit like a little slug. And you'll see them on plants. They just move up and down the stems, and they feed on aphids. So they're really wonderful, an example of a wonderful fly to have in your garden, because they're predators when they're young, and then they pollinate when they're older.
Interesting. Andy, you had mentioned something during the break about using fabric softener sheets.
Yes.
That they can somehow deter bugs.
Yeah, the fabric softener is a deterrent. Like if you're going to go on a picnic table, you know, out, all the food you bring is going to be attracted. And they're attracted by the smell and by the type of food you're going to have. So basically taking Bounce, putting it on the table, will admit something else, cover up the smell. It's just like spraying Febreze, and basically they can't find the food.
It repels them,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, so basically, like if you have your trash can outdoor or indoor, you take a toilet bowl deodorant block, and you just stick it in there, but don't rip the paper completely, just where the block, the wire or the plastic goes into the block. You just rip that and you hang it underneath your sink where the pipe comes out. And basically, the fly can't find anything because you all put the trash can and all the chemicals that you have, dishwashing and all that, is food for the flies and roaches and other insects. So it repels not only insects but flying insects. And for the outside, you can buy the mosquito and fly pyrethrum time mist, which goes off every 30 minutes. And basically what it does, it creates a barrier to your back door.
Well, I'll have to try that at my next picnic to put some fabric softener on my picnic table to keep the flies away.
Yeah.
That way I'm not standing there with the plate fanning them away. All right. We have a callback. Richard from the Big Island, you said you had a second question.
Hello.
Yes, what's on your mind?
I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
And you answered my first one. So here it is. I have Alvea for it that borders the back of my property. But the Alvea all died. And it's all full of Christmas there. Now, I don't own them, so I don't know what they're going to do with it. But I have one Alvea tree that's way out in front of my house. So it's like a couple hundred yards that's away from the forest. And it flowers and it's beautiful. And I'm wondering, is it going to die too? Should I notify anybody that I have a living Alvea?
That's my
question.
So you want to figure out how can you protect that? I don't know, Darcy. What can you do?
You're bringing me down. I'm assuming your Alvea died largely because of rapid Alvea death, and you may have when a resistant tree. Only time will be able to tell. So I would just monitor it closely. You can probably report it to, aren't you going to have, Catherine, some people from USDA on the show later.
Yeah, hopefully we'll talk with them.
Yeah, and it might they might be the person to indicate that we resistance is to rapid Ohia death is probably going to be the only thing that will save the Ohia forest. So breeding resistance and developing resistance, that's going to be a long-term goal. But this is the first steps, identifying plants that are not susceptible and are somehow resisting the disease and surviving despite everything that's happening around them. And it's a form of natural selection.
Well, we're sad about your Ohia trees that died, but we're happy you have that one.
Yeah, exactly.
We have another call from the Big Island from the Hamakua Coast. Rick, do you have a question?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I've had some success this summer bagging tomatoes and watermelons, but for some reason I can't seem to keep whatever that is, moth or whatever that makes the maggot, out of my cantaloupes. Is there a barrier that's better than another barrier? I've made bags out of Remade product for protecting plants.
I'm going to assume that it's pickle worm, and pickle worm is one of the harder crops, actually, harder bugs to actually take care of. And so generally killing the moths are the best approach, and that can be done with any number of different products rated for moths if you read the label. And there's some nice organic solutions to also that will target it. But pickle worm is one of the most difficult things to for professional farmers too, to actually keep ahead of and under control.
Is there any particular bug that's attacking things on another neighbor island? I don't know, does Maui have a problem with something or Kauai and Molokai? I mean, I don't know what you folks are hearing out in the field.
There's always island-specific problems.
Any particular island have an abundance of good bugs? I don't know.
Of good bugs? I don't know. Most people come to me with bad news.
Bad bugs, yeah. Bad bugs. Well, Andy, what about the workshops that you folks are offering at the Board of Water Supply? What have you got coming up?
Well, we have one coming up on the 14th, and basically it's... and one in January. So basically it starts at 9 o'clock and it goes to about 12. But it's always a full house because people want to learn. This year, what I'm going to be doing sometime this week is I'm going to show them how to trap or insects into sticky traps, and different types of traps and monitors could tell you ahead of time before you have a problem. So basically understanding where they're coming from. Some are flying, some are attracted to the different colors, and some are just, I put them in PVC pipes, things like that. And this way we check it within 2 weeks, and that tells me what you're having around your garden.
So you're not just talking the sticky traps that you just buy at the hardware store. Are these special
traps? Yeah, they are special ones, and they are colored ones. And I give them samples during my class, and they can order it online and pick it up at do-it-yourself, do your own pest control. And it's quite reasonable. And, you know, you got 100 to 300 of these insect traps there. But you got to remember, you know, you can be proactive. Use diatomaceous in the potting soil that you're going to mix, and also you can mix it with water and spray it onto the plant. It doesn't hurt the plant in any way. You know, you can even use rubbing alcohol, 91%, to kill an insect that's on your, like, white flies or a caterpillar. Just spray it with rubbing alcohol. It's a contact, but no residual. But if you want it to last a little, I mean, not last, but if you want to also take care of the eggs and the larvae stage, add some soap to it and basically encases the eggs and the caterpillars where they can't breathe and they suffocate.
Oh, interesting.
So it's, and It doesn't, it takes care of my, when I take my dog for a walk before I bring him in, I spray him with 91% rubbing alcohol. And if there's, if they picked up any fleas or ticks, it kills them on contact.
Oh, interesting. So alcohol and soap, dishwashing
yes.
soap. That's a good tip.
Yeah.
Okay. Gosh, what else? Is there anything as far as the pollinators, you know, as far as like seasons, you know, we're getting into the hurricane season. We'll be into the, hopefully the wet season soon because this heat is just crazy hot.
Oh my goodness. I can't wait for the heat to break. So, you know, here in Hawaii, we don't necessarily have seasons in the same way that they do on the mainland. So honeybees are native to temperate climates and they are accustomed to having a winter season. They collect honey. That's why we call them honeybees. So they have something to eat all winter. We co-opt that biology and steal their honey and then move them someplace a little bit warmer and hopefully they can pollinate, you know, down in the south. So here in Hawaii, we don't have to deal with that. Honeybees are active year-round. They do still decrease productivity a bit in the winter. So they do have an internal clock that's just telling their biology, scale down, guys, it's winter time. When we do enter the rainy season, it can sometimes be a bit more difficult for bees, honeybees specifically. If you have a ton of water, it actually can throw off plant flowering. And so then they won't have access to as many flowers in the environment. So if they're not collecting the nectar and pollen, then they don't have anything to eat. So they can undergo periods of starvation.
Right. And I think last time you were on, we were talking about the problems on the Big Island, I think, with the vog and how the bees were suffering.
Right, yeah. I mean, so we don't know a whole lot about how volcanoes affect honeybees still, other than kind of direct mechanical. So if ash falls on the honeybee, then it's going to interfere with their exoskeleton and potentially cause impacts that way. But also if it gets into the nectar, it can cause issues just when they're feeding on it because it's like swallowing small pieces of glass for them. So, you know, using a supplemental feed is okay during certain times of the year. So yes, if there's some type of catastrophic event going on in the state, like a volcanic eruption, or even if we're dealing with periods of drought or super heavy rainfall, it's okay to provide supplemental feed to your honeybees. So you can do a 50-50 water and table sugar solution to give to honeybees as a nectar substitute. And then you can also purchase protein supplements that you can put into the hive. And so that'll have the same nutritional balance as pollen. Alternatively, you can collect pollen. So put a pollen trap on the entrance to a hive. So as the bees fly back, it kind of knocks the pollen balls off. And you can collect that and freeze that and then provide that back to your bees during a time when pollen isn't available.
Okay. And then, Andy, any advice, let's say, for gardeners who have gardens on their lanais, because not everybody has a backyard, but if you've got fruits and vegetables on your lanai and you live in a high rise,
yeah.
Any thoughts about attracting
good
bugs?
Yeah, you can attract them by, again, adding some flowers that attract. You know, that's the thing. And when you grow anything in your pots or whatever, you've got to take care of it. Food, water, and shelter. Then insects are no different than us. We need all those three, you know. And if we give them good supplement, a healthy plant that is well taken care of can fight off all kinds of diseases, just like us. If we don't take our vitamins, our immune system goes down, and we get attacked. That's why ants are good, they're enemies to us and plants, because they're the ones that move the aphids, whiteflies, scale insects from a dying plant to a healthy plant, and they protect them against all other predators. So basically, you know, if you control your ants, you'll control a lot of whiteflies, scale insects.
So how do we control the ants then?
Well, if you live in a high rise, rubbing alcohol, 91%, will kill them on contact. Diatomaceous will help in the soil. And just keep fertilizing your plants and give them a lot of sunlight, what they need to flower.
Because if you have a bunch on your trees,
Yeah.
Just try and use the alcohol then?
Yeah, just rubbing alcohol. It's a contact. So it doesn't help kill the plant, because by the time it hits the plant, it evaporates. That's why it's just like me spraying spraying you with acid. If I spray you with acid, we have HMSA medical coverage. Insects don't.
Okay.
So any wounded prey become prey to others.
Okay. We did have another caller on the line. He wanted Chrissy to talk about swarming bees. Are they dangerous? Is it natural occurrence? Talk about that.
Absolutely. So swarming is a natural part of honeybee biology, and typically it happens in the spring. In Hawaii, it can be more of a year-round occurrence again. But what happens is the colony, as it's coming out of overwintering, the queen is laying more eggs. She's building up the number of workers in the hive, which will then be going out and foraging once the spring bloom happens. And as that colony continues to grow, they're running low on space. So the old queen will take a retinue of those workers, and they'll leave. They'll leave behind the rest of the workers, who will then make a new queen to take over. Beekeepers can, when they're monitoring their colonies, see this happening, and what they can do is what's called a split. So before the old queen takes some workers and leaves, they can just do that on their own and go from one hive to two. The swarm, however, is when they do escape. It's actually one of the most passive points that the honeybees will ever be. So you may see them clumping on a tree branch, or maybe under a bench or somewhere near your home. They're not dangerous when they're like that. They've just formed a clump around the old queen, and they're sending scouts out looking for a new location to start a new hive.
Okay, but let's say at my front door, and I want to get in my front door. I mean, Darcy, what would you do?
If you know it's a swarm, and swarms are not aggressive. So bees will protect. Bees become aggressive when they have a home to protect. So when they go from a swarm to being a hive, and they start laying down they start being domestic and laying down wax and start collecting honey and have brood and all these other things of bees that are making house. That's when they're in a protective phase. So a swarm is really something, I wouldn't say they're gentle, but they're not aggressive. And so you can do a lot of things with a swarm that you cannot do with a hive. And being allergic to bees, I'm not afraid of swarms. I am afraid of hives. But when in doubt, find a beekeeper.
Yeah.
Give them a call. They can take care of your swarm problem, or potentially your hive problem, and move on.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't want them to build a nest in your wall.
Yeah, because we need our pollinators, but our pollinators need to be in the right places, and your front porch is not the right place for a pollinator.
Yeah.
Okay. Especially one that forms hives like a bee.
Yeah, I work with a beekeeper, and also he's a pest control. He has two companies. One, he's exterminator, but also he raises bees. So basically I call him within half an hour, he's there. He'll collect the bees, especially if they're swarmers, because you can basically go to that hive and scoop them into a box. And once you get the queen in there, that's it. They're docile at that point, you know. And basically, if they're already in your wall, then he has pheromones that will attract them to come out and go into, and he'll remove those too.
Okay, end of bee problem.
Yes.
Okay. Real quick, ladybugs. I have a lot of black ladybugs in my yard. I don't see the orange ones or the red ones very much anymore. And there's no place you can really go to buy ladybugs. I mean, I think on the mainland you can, but that's not really something you see often here.
Yeah, we used to have someone from university used to raise them and sell them. But basically, you can take a brown bag, walk your neighborhood, see any plants that are overhanging, especially like plumeria trees and look for ladybugs and just collect them, put them in the brown bag, and then you come home and release them. And basically, they feed on whitefly, scale insects, aphids, because they will lay their eggs in that area, and they feed on the eggs of the bad bugs.
Okay, so you can steal your neighbor's ladybugs.
Well, they're free. They're advertising. They're hanging out.
All right.
And that's it.
We have a couple of minutes left. Any final thoughts about how to encourage the good guys in your garden?
Absolutely. So I always like to encourage people, as I mentioned, to let certain things in your garden bolt. So planting herbs, so insectary plants. But there's a number of native plants here in Hawaii that can also serve in that role. So, you know, you're conserving not only pollinators, but also the cultural and ecological heritage here in Hawaii. And I would encourage people to check out my extension website, where I have native Hawaiian plants for honeybees, and I have lists specific to each island. So people can look up what's most relevant to their location. I've got information on whether they're used culturally in lei making, edible, traditionally in Hawaiian medicine, and then information about their bloom period and generally about soil types they'll grow in, with links to further information in the state on proper growing conditions for these plants.
Okay.
And are good for pollinators.
All right. And any final thoughts from the ag side, Darcy?
All bugs are good.
All bugs are good. So
they all have a purpose.
Yeah, and basically, just take care of your plants, just like you would take care of yourself. A healthy plant can fight off everything.
Yeah.
And basically, just, it's a work in progress. The more you do it, the more you learn what to do, what not to do. And just remember, spring and fall, that's when you have most of the bugs coming out.
That does it for today's rebroadcast on the good bugs in our gardens. We'd once again like to thank our guests, Andrew the Bug Doctor Nowinski, UHM researcher Chrissy Mogren, and the Department of Agriculture's Darcy Oishi. And we thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. While our phone lines weren't live for today's discussion, you can still contact the Talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. Give it a call. We'd love to hear from you. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And to listen back to today's show or to find a past one, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.